You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
Ah, good morning, listeners. Sorry about the delay there. You are listening to Green Left Radio, and we're coming to you live from the 3CR studios here in Fitzroy. So welcome to the show. I'm Chloe, one of your hosts. It's really good to be back in the studio, and I have Zane with me as well. Good morning, Zane.
Top of the morning to you.
3CR and Green Left recognise that this show is being broadcasted on the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people. This land was never ceded. It was taken by force. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. And that struggle for First Nation sovereignty is connected with the struggles against racism, border imperialism and capitalism. We stand with First Nations peoples for justice, sovereignty and land rights. We've got a good show for you today. So what's on the show today? We'll start with a few news headlines and Green Left articles. At 7:20, we have an interview with Narendra from the Indian diaspora to talk about the fight back against rising Islamophobia, including the protests against Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit to Australia and his influence on the Indian diaspora here. At 7:40, we'll be playing a pre-recorded interview, Where is Malaysia's Gen Z Revolt? Green Left speaks to a youth activist in the Socialist Party of Malaysia about how right-wing politicians are channeling rising mass dissatisfaction into racist scapegoating of minorities. 8 a.m. we have the activist calendar, and then lastly at 8:10 we will be joined by activist and organizer in the Palestine movement, Sarah Barini, who is also from the Lebanese community. She'll be giving us an update of the current situation on the ground in Lebanon, including some of the ecological and social crises. But first up, some headlines or some news.
Yes.
What's happening, Zane? In the world?
Well, I think probably be good to talk about Venezuela. The worst earthquakes to hit that region in 125 years struck about a week ago. There's news today of a security guard being pulled out of the basement of a collapsed apartment building. And if you've seen some of the footage coming out of Venezuela, it's really horrific. Lots of multi-story buildings, including what appears to be a large, probably a large number of public housing buildings that were built during the, I guess you would say, the good years of the socialist project in Venezuela, before the economy really started going bad and before the government took a bit of a authoritarian turn and sort of walked away from that project. A lot of those public housing buildings have collapsed, and there's tens of thousands of people still missing in Venezuela, which is really disturbing. And there's an article at Link's Journal of Socialist Renewal, and that article is it's called The Political, Social and Economic Impact of Venezuela's Twin Earthquakes. That's well worth a look. It's by the Autonomous and Independent Workers Committee. And so that group has been organizing in the community to respond to the earthquake. One of the key messages that group and other voices from Venezuela are putting forward is that the U.S. are still withholding 70% of Venezuela's oil income, and a lot of sanctions and so on still remain in place. So this is really hampering the recovery. The Venezuelan economy is still very heavily reliant on oil exports, and at the moment the U.S. have perpetrated this soft coup earlier in the year, kidnapped the Venezuelan president and his partner, and since then they've been withholding 70% of oil revenue, and that is still happening right now as the country now tries to recover, begin the process of recovering, and they're still trying to rescue people. And I guess some of the images coming out of Venezuela are really from downtown Caracas, looking at these multi-story apartment buildings and so on that have collapsed. But we know that a significant percentage of the poorest population of Venezuelans living around Caracas are in the barrios up in the hillsides all around the city of Caracas. And these are often sort of improvised dwellings that have been built on the hillsides. And I have no doubt whatsoever that given that those buildings are on the side of a hill rather than on flat ground, and given that they have been built with whatever materials people can get, and you know that they're probably not built with some sort of high earthquake rating because that's really expensive and requires engineering, I think it's most likely that there will be lots and lots and lots of those houses all around the barrios that have collapsed. And there's definitely reports of people trapped in the rubble there. They can't get heavy machinery in. And of course, this ongoing US restrictions on the Venezuelan economy makes it that little bit harder to, you know, pay the money to get heavy machinery in to dig people out of the rubble. So yeah, it's a mess. Keep an eye out. I'm not aware of community fundraisers at the moment, but I'm sure there is, and there'll be places where you can donate online to help, you know, crowdfunding efforts to help with recovery efforts over there. So keep an eye out for that.
Mm-hmm. We express our deepest solidarity with the people of Venezuela following those devastating earthquakes, and calls to lift the sanctions. Just so many lives were lost after the earthquake in Syria back in 2023 because the Biden administration delayed help and limited the sanction waivers. And now the Trump administration is maintaining those sanctions on Venezuela that could stop and, well, they're slowing down relief efforts. So, yeah, it's really vital that immediate humanitarian and reconstruction efforts can be deployed to Venezuela. And yeah, I was just reading an article in Green Left where we've quoted the Center for Economic and Policy Research saying that the British and Portuguese governments should act immediately to secure the release of billions of dollars of Venezuelan assets held by the Bank of England and Novo Banco, so that these financial resources, which are the property of the Venezuelan state, can be used to support humanitarian and reconstruction efforts. I mean, these sanctions are killing Venezuelans. You know, that they're responsible for tens and thousands, maybe even hundreds of deaths. All right, we're going to go to a quick break and come back with some more news.
Because the Palestinian fight isn't just the Palestinians' fight, it's all our fight, because it's a fight not just about land, it's about a fight for freedom.
Everybody should be standing here today saying, Free Palestine.
Solidarity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters, on behalf of the Gumbanja Nation, my people, who've never ceded their sovereignty.
We should be recognising Palestine as a state and recognising the rights of Palestinians.
3CR. Stay tuned, stay radical.
Welcome back. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 in AM dial, or all in the podcast. You're with Zane and Chloe, and what else? At the moment, there is a big heat wave all across Europe, and that is quite scary for those of us who are climate train spotters, because it's real hot. It's way hotter than normal. I read a report not long ago, I think it was yesterday, saying that the highest ever sea surface temperature ever recorded in the Mediterranean has just been recorded, and it's a couple of degrees higher, something like 30 or 32 degrees Celsius sea level temperature. Meanwhile, in northern Siberia, in the Arctic Circle, there's been temperatures recorded as high as 38 degrees Celsius. That's really bad, because up in the Arctic Circle, you've got permafrost. When that melts, it releases large amounts of methane. The methane goes into the atmosphere and makes climate change worse. The heat melts the North Pole. The North Pole melts. That shuts down, weakens the Arctic meridional overturning circulation, AMOC, and that's really further destabilised the climate. So it's a cascading shit show, and yeah, across Europe, really hot in the cities. There's been excess deaths, thousands of excess deaths. Power stations, nuclear power stations in France, are once again shutting down because they rely on water from rivers for cooling, including the river Seine, and the water is too warm, and when your input water going into those nuclear power stations is too warm, it's not doing its job properly to cool it down, so they've had to reduce the output of those nuclear power stations. Just another reason that we should not build them in Australia. They're very thirsty, and they are prone to crapping out when it gets too hot. Yeah, so it's really disturbing, and there's a super El Nino has kicked in, a change to the global climate system, which traditionally brings hotter, drier weather to Australia. So there's a good chance this summer is going to be a scorcher in Australia. And I think it's been the worst start to a snow season in Australia on record. So it's a pretty warm winter here already. And yeah, it could be a very hot summer. So
yeah, it has been a warm winter. I thought it was just me dealing with the winter a bit better with just rugging up. But yeah, there was this, I was reading this ABC article titled Australia's Heat Wave History Offers Lessons for Sweltering Europe. And it talks about adapting the climate change, or how we're adapting to climate change, and by looking at housing designs for future climate. I suspect these safeguards against climate will only help the richest people while the rest of us suffer. But instead of claiming to work for a safer climate, if Australia wants to really safeguard against the climate and set an example, it can start by not being the world's second biggest exporter of carbon emissions. Australia's the world's third largest fossil fuel exporter after Russia and the United States. And because Australia exports so much coal, It's the second largest exporter of fossil fuel carbon dioxide emissions. So this is, yeah, this is why we need to keep building the climate movement, and why campaigns like Rising Tide or the People's Blockade are so important to support.
Yes, and Rising Tide up in Mullumbimby, Newcastle, they've been working on a campaign at the moment to oppose the HVO expansion. What is HVO? Is that a song by Jay-Z? No, it's Hunter Valley Operations. It's a massive coal mine. It's got an open cut component and an underground component. So it's a sort of a twin, two coal mines in one. And they are at the moment applying for a huge, huge expansion, which would permit them to export, I think it's 40 million tons a year of coal. Now, to put that into perspective, the annual output of the Port of Newcastle, which draws on, there'd have to be about 20 different coal mines, I reckon, that feed coal down the coal chain and export out of Newcastle. The entire output of the Port of Newcastle, which is the world's largest coal exporting port, is about 150 million tons per year. On a good year, it's been flatlining lately a bit. This expansion by HVO would allow them to dig up 40 million tons a year. So that's sort of nearly a quarter of the entire output of the Port of Newcastle at the moment would be coming out of this one combined mining operation. So there's a campaign at the moment to get people to submit submissions to the Planning Assessment Commission against that. And to me, this also links to the rise of One Nation that we've been seeing at the moment. One of the seats federally where One Nation has polled strongest across Australia is the seat of Hunter. Seat of Hunter takes in Cessnock and Singleton and some of these coal mining areas. It's currently, the current member there is Dan Repiccioli for the Labor Party. That seat has been held by the Labor Party for about 115 years and it's got a long union history. However, in recent years, Stuart Bonds, who is a mining union member, has run as a candidate for One Nation in that area. And I think two elections ago, 2019, he got the strongest result ever outside of when Pauline Hanson won Ipswich as an independent back in, or the seat of Oxley back in the day. Stuart Bonds got like 20-something percent of the primary vote. That's dipped at the most recent election, but there was some polling from Redbridge came out maybe a month or so ago. And that was saying One Nation is on the rise in the polls. We expect them to win some seats. And one of the seats that they are likely to win is the seat of Hunter. And to me, the message being pushed by Stuart Bonds and One Nation is, well, it's kind of the same as what Liberal and Labor are saying. We support the coal industry. We will keep approving coal mines. We will keep digging it up because we support mine workers. What's really missing is a clear transition plan for coal workers, a program of public investment to build up alternative jobs so that as the world stops buying coal, there are alternative jobs for coal mining workers to go to. Until there is a viable transition plan, those workers very much will, and with some legitimacy, look at the situation and say, well, we've got a choice here between the very high unemployment that exists outside of the coal industry in this area or working in the coal industry. And I've got friends who work up there. They know it's a destructive industry. They know what climate change is. But given a choice between unemployment or some low-paid, crappy hospitality job or something versus working a well-paid job in a still a fairly well-unionized industry in coal mining, people do choose that option. So the lack of a viable transition is really a problem. And I think it's incumbent upon rank-and-file trade unionists, and if you're listening to this across Melbourne or wherever you're listening, if you think it's not that great. The idea of a mining union member potentially winning the seat of Hunter and on a platform of let's smash the greenies and let's keep digging up coal forever and climate change is bullshit. If you think that that is a dangerous prospect, well, you've got to speak up. You've got to come along to the People's Blockade of the World's Largest Coal Port at the end of February 2027. We need to see more union members at the blockade speaking up and sending clear message to coal workers. If you dig your heels in and push for a transition, there are union members across the country that are going to stand up and be counted and stand with you and help you to win that, because it's not an easy campaign to win, but it is winnable. But people need to stand up and be counted. And I think that's a real problem. And I look at this push to approve this massive new coal mine expansion up in Newcastle, up in the Hunter, in that context. The union movement in particular really needs to step up and start pushing for a viable transition so that workers have some other choice between more coal mining versus unemployment, because at the moment that's kind of the two choices there are. There's not a real viable transition plan in place.
Yep. Stay tuned for more Green Left. We've got our first interview coming up. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR.
Always bringing you the latest union news.
They're coming after us at the moment. They want to get rid of penalty rates, the big push from businesses. They want to get rid of all the things that you and I have fought for.
So there's tens of thousands of jobs gone, contracted out to sham contracting arrangements.
On 8.55 a.m. and on the web, 3cr.org.au.
The revolution in Rojava is a beacon of hope for the world, putting direct democracy and feminism into practice on a broad scale. This radical attempt at social transformation now faces huge challenges, including daily attacks by the Turkish military with little outside recognition or aid. Show your support for Rojava by joining Northeast Syria Solidarity, or NESS, and help ensure the survival of this inspiring experiment in social change. NESS sends aid, raises awareness, and builds solidarity. Get involved at www.nesssolidarity.org.au. NESS is a 3CR supporter.
Welcome back. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and we are joined now by Narendra from the Indian diaspora. Welcome to the show, Narendra. Can you hear us?
Oh, yes, I can. Thanks for having me, Chloe.
Yeah, it's really good to have you on the show. I'm just going to launch into the first question that I wanted to ask, because there is a rise of Islamophobia here in Australia, and you're currently organising protests against the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who's due to visit Australia soon.
Yep.
Could we start by maybe you explaining what Islamophobia is, and maybe tell us a little bit about the huge spike in hate speech and Islamophobia, and even the statewide violence that mainly targets Muslims, leading to widespread deaths and rapes and arson and the destruction of property that is sponsored by the BJP, and some of the protests held against anti-Muslim violence in India. But yeah, start off with what, you know, tell us what Islamophobia is.
So Islamophobia is essentially anti-Muslim racism, and it's not individual hate. It's normalizing hatred against Muslims by portraying them as dangerous, foreign, violent, and a threat to our way of life, right? And once that idea becomes normal, then these Muslims are harassed. Women wearing hijab are attacked upon. For instance, a few years ago, we had a pregnant woman here in one of the cafeterias here, was just going about a normal day and having a good time with her friends and having some coffee. Some person comes behind her, gets into an argument, violently assaults her and kicks her on her pregnant belly, and a lot of people didn't really, you know, get up to stop that. So that's how it normalizes hatred and assaults of Muslims, and that's really troubling in relation to the whole thing about rising Islamophobia. So the Office of the Special Envoy to Counter Islamophobia found that 1 in 3 Australians have negative views of Muslims. What that does and why it's bad to our society is that it divides people. So it's Muslims today and First Nations people today. It might be trade unionists tomorrow, and so on and so forth. And we find that increasing even more in light of the anti-migrant rhetoric from Pauline Hanson. Why is that important to all of us? Because it, you know, distracts us and divides us from fighting against corporate greed and, you know, increasing housing prices, the cost of living crisis. So that's to your first question about Islamophobia in Australia and why it's important to address it. Is that fair? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Narendra, for that description. Can you tell us a little bit about Hindutva and the far-right Indian, just far-right Indian nationalism, and maybe its connection to the disturbing rise of Islamophobia in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, so the Hindutva is really an ideology inspired by European fascism. So some of the leaders of Hindutva, there is a group called the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh. Some of them literally went to, had associations with both Mussolini and Hitler and said that we should replicate the Jewish experiment in India with Muslims. And you see a lot of that narrative around genocidal narrative becoming even more popularized since Narendra Modi's in his regime. To give you some data on that, the amount of hate. So between 2023 and 2024, there was a 74% increase in hate speech events, which is violence. And of that, almost all of them occurred in states ruled by Narendra Modi's BJP party. These have been documented extensively by the Human Rights Watch. The United States Special Commission on International Religious Freedom actually has designated India as a country of particular concern. People who speak up against it, press, they are, you know, attacked. India right now is 157 out of 180 countries in press freedom. They have thrown out Amnesty International. Journalists are being criminalized. Umar Khalid is a guy, is one of those examples who's been in jail for 6 years without a trial. So that is the amount of human rights violations and anti-minority hate. To give you a magnitude of how much the anti-minority hate is, there are about 4 hate speech incidents per day against Muslims and similarly against Christians. So it's a huge problem. How is it coming to Australia? Well, you know, a lot of this hate gets transmitted through online social media platforms, and they account for more than half of all hate speech against Muslims in Australia. So it is a real challenge and to our social cohesion, and something that needs to be addressed, as a matter of priority.
Absolutely. And it was incredible to see 300 million people take to the streets in India in that historical, in that historic national strike in February. Farmers, students, workers, they professionals, they all went on strike and in defence of their rights, and you know, they're denouncing the policies of Narendra Modi's ultra right-wing government. So it's good to see that there is opposition, that kind of opposition taken. But I wanted to move on to an organisation that you're part of. Narendra, tell us about Alliance Against Islamophobia.
So Alliance Against Islamophobia is an organisation that adopts a policy, political and legal advocacy, to help Australia understand the threats of far-right and extremism. So it's really about educating, organising and helping people counter it. It is one of the four organisations that has been designated as one of the reporting of by the Office of the Special Envoy to Counter Islamophobia, so it collects hate speech, helps the government understand the magnitude of it, and works with government to counter it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for explaining Alliance Against Islamophobia. I don't know if Zane wanted to ask a question about... I don't know, pass it on to Zane. We wanted to ask about the protests as well, but yeah.
Can you tell us about Modi's visit and also this protest that's coming up on Thursday, Narendra?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is, you know, why should we protest against Modi? Well, our relationship with India should not be based on corporate greed, but it should be based on human rights. Now, there is a huge problem with human rights, as we just discussed, attacks on Muslims, minorities, repression of journalists, civil society, and criminalization of dissent. And if we're going to turn away from that and just concentrate on, on the market, in the Indian market, then I think we, you know, we lose a moral obligation to raise that. So I think, especially from the left, it is really important that these constructs of, you know, Hindu nationalism are challenged. Because they distract from the real issues, contribute to inequality, and contribute to corporate power. So we need to oppose Modi's visit. Now, so that's important of it. Now, the logistic of it, we're still working on that because it's not really clear. They've been deferring, accounts of where the event's going to be held. But I think there will be a Facebook page where we'll try to keep the community abreast of the plans. Do consider following that.
Okay. And, how can people keep track of that and keep up to date about that protest and potentially come along? And...
So we'll try to provide updates on the Alliance Against Islamophobia Facebook page and our web page too. You can reach our web page by going to aai.support, S-U-P-P-O-R-T, aai.support. So that way you can keep track of it. And we encourage everyone to come and join the protest.
Word.
Thank you.
Rock and roll.
Yeah, thank you, Narendra, and for the people in your community who are organising the protests. And yeah, I think for everyone listening, it is important that we show solidarity, particularly with the Muslim community, and stand against racism and hatred. It's been really great having you on the show, Narendra. Before we wrap up the interview, let us know if there's anything else you would like listeners to know.
I think our message is simple, right? I think we need to come together to say no to fascism, no to corporate greed, yes to solidarity, equality and justice. So that's what this protest is about. It's not about any religion. It's not about any racial group. It's about coming together. And we encourage everyone to come together, stand in solidarity and fight corporate greed.
Yeah, nice. All right. Thanks heaps, Narendra. And, yeah, we'll keep an eye out for the rally on Thursday, July 9.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you, Narendra. You were just listening to Narendra from the Indian diaspora talking to us about the fight back against rising Islamophobia and an upcoming protest against Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit to Australia. All right, we're going to go to a song. It's called Nobody by Dead Pioneers. Stay tuned. You are listening to Green Left on 3CR.
When they ask you who your favorite Indian is, say nobody. Nobody is everybody while being nobody at all. Nobody eats beans from a can, a traditional gesture to honor the great white father's provisions. A commodity to some, a commodity for nobody. Nobody has feathers and carries them everywhere, you know, just in case. Nobody can start a fire with matches better than any white man. I would put nobody against any white man on spaghetti Western quotes, especially the Clint Eastwood parts. Nobody is Cherokee and Navajo with a touch of Paiute deriving from the royalty of indigeneity. He is nobody's Indian, as nobody is Indian. More Indian than the most Indian Indian that was ever Indian. And while it's true that Wes Studi drank him under the table once, he's still the Indian's Indian. Nobody holds on to his Indianness the way that white-haired cougars in white leather with turquoise from head to toe clutch their purses when a real Indian walks by them in Santa Fe. When nobody is confronted, he doesn't back down. That'd be $5 for a picture with a real Indian, he said. And when they say no, he punches them in the face and asks for 10. Nobody looks like Gary Farmer, but with sexier moves, a real candidate for diabetes, a high risk for drinking your alcohol with a high probability of being the life of the party. Nobody has no home. Because no Indian is homeless on their homelands, he has no family except his relations, which is everyone and no one. He walks where the buffalo roam. His hair is long and messy. His clothes have been decolonized at the knees with holes in his shirt and stains in his Indian pits. And nobody is your favorite Indian because he is a noble, honorable, shameful fool. You can use him as your token Indian friend. Proud statement to your culturally diverse friend group. You can mad dog nobody when you're tired of hearing him state, "This is our land." But nobody cares. It's because nobody is every Indian and no Indian. He is your mascot, your court jester, your token Indian joke. And one day nobody will no longer be nobody. He will be the remnant of your disembodied heads that are your romantic novel Indians. He will think you into nothingness, and nobody will be out of your sight while he is out of his mind. Nobody. Nobody. Nobody.
Yes, so that was Dead Pioneers. They're this sort of, what would you call them, spoken word punk out of Colorado in the USA. They've got a new album called Wagon Burner, and that song was called Nobody. They've got some other songs on there which we would like to have played, but we've got to be careful here at 3CR when we play songs that have got the spicy words on them.
Especially morning.
Especially this time of morning when people are maybe on their way to school and their
school holidays.
Hey, okay, so. Well.
Forgot about that.
Well, maybe we could have played one with some spicy words because all the kids are sleeping in or playing with their friends. That's a really cool band. The singer is Greg Deal, who's a First Nations American Indian. And, yeah, he's got some other really cool songs. There's one called Bad Indian, which if you haven't heard it, check it out because it's really... it's really cool. So, yeah, Dead Pioneers off Nobody off their new album, Wagon Burner. And that's from Matt Ward's compilation, 10 New Albums That Ridicule Racist Billionaires and Bigots. So Matt Ward does a monthly wrap-up of new radical music, and that was one of his picks from his latest.
In Green Left, yeah. Well, listeners, we did promise to play you a pre-recorded interview at 7:40 on where is Malaysia's Gen Z revolt headed. It's a really great interview with a youth activist in the Socialist Party of Malaysia, but we are running a little bit over time here, and so we just thought we might go into a little bit more news and analysis instead. And maybe you can, you know, you can find that interview if we don't get time to play it today. It you can just go to greenleft.org.au and search up the interview.
Yes. I've got an article in the most recent Green Left about public housing. Australia needs a big build of public housing. And one of the ways that One Nation has been gaining traction is around the cost of living crisis and the housing crisis. And they've got this toxic racist approach where they're like, oh yeah, we'll make housing cheaper by banning immigration. And basically trying to blame the housing crisis on immigrants. And I reckon that's a pretty shitty approach, and it's, well, above all else, it's wrong. Even in the current situation where we've got negative gearing and all these other things, like the contribution of immigration to house prices in Australia is quite small. It's quite a minor factor in house prices. And what I argue in my article is that a much bigger factor is, yes, negative gearing, capital gains tax discounts that John Howard bought in 26 years ago. That's definitely played a role. But also the decline in investment in public housing. And in my article, I quote a recently released report from the Green Institute. And Max Chandler Mather has been travelling around the land talking about that report. After World War II, 18% of all dwellings built in Australia were by the various state-based departments of public works building public housing and apartments. That has dropped away. So there was a very low amount of public housing sort of up to the period of World War II, and actually a factor in World War II was, I guess, capitalism reverting to its most exploitative, hardcore, non-welfare state natural center of gravity. And then you had the Russian Revolution, and then you had sort of different capitalist powers fighting each other. So after World War II, there was this kind of war dividend, and there was this idea of capitalism can be nice and we can have nice things, and you don't have to have a revolution, workers, because we'll make capitalism nice for you. And so as part of that process, there was a big build of public housing. And so over the sort of 50 years or so after the end of World War II, Australia's public housing stock gradually built up and built up, and it reached a high of about 5% of dwellings. But over the last 30 years or so, that number has slowly declined. It's gone backwards to the point where today we're now at about 3% public housing in Australia. Now, compare that to some other countries in Europe, like the Netherlands in particular. 29.1% of housing in the Netherlands is public housing. Austria, 24%. Scotland, 24%. Denmark, 21%. Sweden, 17%. England, 17%. France, 16%. So other countries...
what are we? What's the
3%. So
shame on the Australian government.
Yeah, yeah. The other countries have between 5 to 8 times the amount of public housing as a proportion of the overall housing stock compared to Australia. And it's not a magic bullet. Like, rent is still expensive in the Netherlands and England and some of these countries. But the point is, if you've got millions of dwellings of public housing and they've got fixed rents, then you might have a 6 month or 1 year waiting list to get into public housing instead of like a 2 or 3 or 5 year waiting list to get into public housing in Australia, because it's just so unreachable. So, I think it's really important to point out that One Nation, they oppose progressive taxation of corporations and the rich. They oppose public housing, and One Nation are not going to build more public housing if they get voted in. They're not going to address the housing crisis. Yeah, they'll cut down on immigrants, but that's not going to fix the situation. We need a big build of public housing, and I would argue there's part of that, and this Green Institute report that's recently come out says the same thing. We need to re-establish these publicly owned property developers that we used to have that built this housing. In the age of neoliberalism, since the mid-80s, the Department of Public Works was abolished by the states, and all building of schools, roads, rail, hospitals and public housing, the small amount that was getting built, it's all done by private property developers. Are private building companies, and that makes things heaps more expensive, and it's worse for workers in the construction industry as well. There's less apprenticeships, there's parasitic labor hire companies making heaps of money off workers, so it would be much more cost effective, less room for corruption, cheaper, and more apprentices will get churned out of the system if we re-establish those Department of Public Works, those publicly owned building companies, and get stuck into a big build of public housing. Like, we need to be building tens of thousands of units of public housing per year for like 10 or 15 years to start to catch up and start to nudge up the percentage of public housing.
Yeah, it's a really good article by you, Zane, in Green Left. It's for listeners, it's called Australia Needs a Big Build of Public Housing. And yeah, I mean, most public housing in Australia, if I'm not mistaken, is at least 40 years old. It's been badly neglected, and sometimes it's badly built. Not all, some are well built, but the structures are fine, and that's why we're arguing for it to not all be demolished. But yeah, this is what happens, right? The government lets things like public housing fall apart on purpose, doesn't put money into vital things. I mean, this is shelter for humans.
Mm.
And then they get to say things like it needs to be torn down. And it's because they drain the money in the first place. Then they get to say it's not working. It's not working because you didn't fund it properly all these years. You let it deteriorate. And instead of funding the militarization of the state and weapons and, you know, building coal and gas mines everywhere, this is actually what we need. And I think people might have been paying attention to the Waterloo public housing, that campaign around Waterloo public housing. New South Wales police and riot squad officers were brought in by the Minns government to clear protesters out from there, because housing activists and tenants were occupying a part of the Waterloo public housing estate to stop the demolition of 150 homes. And it just goes to show that not only are state governments interested in building more public housing, they want to demolish it for not because of the concerns about social housing and quality and outcome for tenants. It's because Waterloo, that's in New South Wales, and even over here, Burrup Beacon. I don't know if people remember Burrup Beacon in Port Melbourne, which is a bayside area, view of the sea, view of the bay. It was another public housing campaign that we lost a few years ago. All these areas are selected. They're targeted because it is highly coveted real estate, and the land values are high enough for the project to go ahead with no net loss of social housing. The state government can just gentrify the area and push residents out from their homes. But yeah, this is what the article is talking about as well. And we've written so many other articles in Green Left about alternative approaches to redevelopment. And the office, if you, you can read, there's this, I think they're a architecture, I'm not sure actually, it's called Office. They're really great. They've actually led several design and feasibility studies for the retrofitting of public housing, including for Waterloo North and Central. And it's called the Retain, Repair, Reinvest Waterloo North and Central Project. So there are so many solutions being put forward, and yet the government brings in, this is the thing, they bring in police to shut down these protesters. They want to silence people. So those 40 riot police and contractors, they evicted everyone. They put up the eviction notices. They dismantled the encampment and established construction fencing. So just solidarity to all those activists who camped out there for many nights and tried their best to save a public housing.
And to everyone who's doing the same across Melbourne at the moment, like 44 Flats United and the
Flemington.
Yeah, it's kind of gross too. Like I was on the scrolls the other day and I saw this video from the New South Wales Labor government, and it's Charlie XCX. Is it epic and rock music? And it's this like feel good video about how the New South Wales government is making record investment in public housing.
They used the word public housing
or social housing. I don't know the exact language that they're using, but it was just such bollocks. Like, there is absolutely not a record big build of public housing at the moment. And yeah, if you tweak the numbers and you make it look like there's record investment, but no, there's not. There's actually, I think, been a very minor increase of like 100 houses or something. Like it's pathetic. There's a few little projects here and there in New South Wales where they're building 20 houses here and 20 houses there of social and affordable housing, probably very little actual public housing. And then they turn around and have this feel-good video and make it look like they're doing the thing that needs to happen, which is a big build of public housing. And no wonder people are turning to the toxic politics of One Nation when you've got people, neoliberal status quo, like the New South Wales and Victorian governments, and then those governments turn around and pretend like what they're doing is really progressive and like, oh yeah, we're building all this new housing. We're fixing. You're not fixing anything. You are lying. You are bullshitting. What you're really doing is sending the cops in to kick people out of public housing so that you can privatise it by stealth and knock it all down and rebuild it. And a big slab of what gets built there is going to be private.
The people most in need sometimes have to wait years for public housing. I don't know what those waiting lists are like, but it's horrendous. And when you said 3% public housing before, I remember just a couple of years ago repeating the statistic 4%. or 4.something% public housing. So it's gone. You can see the destruction of public housing. It's gone down over 1% already in the space of what, a year or so, or
yeah,
2 years.
And I think part of that is taking public housing and handing it over to these, social housing agencies who charge more. Tenants have less rights.
Yeah.
So that's part of why that number has gone down.
Please support our public. I'm here in NAM. There's a lot of work being done by housing activists. We do cover it a lot in Green Left, so please head to the pages of Green Left and check out some of the Save Public Housing campaigns. We're going to come back shortly. Stay tuned for the Green Left activist calendar.
The state Labor government has begun works on demolishing Melbourne's 44 public housing towers to be replaced with private housing. Already, hundreds of residents have been displaced, often into unsuitable homes under duress.
The towers on Racecourse Road, Flemington, have become Homes Victoria work sites, while the families still living in the buildings are being treated appallingly.
Join Save Public Housing supporters in solidarity with residents.
Weekdays 7:30 till 9 a.m. as we engage with passing traffic to make some noise and show Jacinta Allen
that the demolition of public housing is unacceptable. Signs and banners provided or bring your own.
There's power in numbers, so see you at 120 Racecourse Road, Flemington, 7:30 till 9 a.m.
Safe Public Housing is a 3CR supporter.
Welcome back to Green Left Radio on 3CR. And it's time for the activist calendar. So today is July the 3rd. It's a Friday and there's going to be a commemorating the legacy of nuclear detonations in the Pacific 80 years on. 6 p.m. tonight at Ballinballin Place, 15 Phoenix Street in Brunswick. There's also going to be a film screening 6 p.m. tonight at the Emerald Archipelago. It's the People's Place. I think that's what the film's called, The People's Place, and it's at 30A Pickett Street in Footscray.
And if you're going to be doing what I'm doing in the wee hours of tomorrow morning and watching the Socceroos v Egypt, you should have a little sleep after the match is finished, and then you should get up, dust yourself off, and head on down to Collingwood Town Hall, because it's the 3CR Community Day.
Yay.
Celebrating 50 years of this rockin' community radio station.
Massive achievement.
And there's going to be limited edition merch, posters from the archives, free entry, of course. There'll be food and music and prizes and stalls.
Raffles. Take a look at the raffle list. It's amazing.
So, yeah, tomorrow, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. At Collingwood Town Hall. Get amongst it. It's the 3CR Community Day.
And we'll be there. There's lots of different shows with stalls, and Green Left will be one of them. So come down and say hello tomorrow. We'll be there from, it starts at 11 and it goes till 4.
And then there's a few rallies. Saturday is Rally Day here in Melbourne Town. So there's a counter rally, Smash Transphobia, Fight for Trans Liberation. That's at 11:30 a.m. at the Victorian Parliament. There is another rally, End US Imperialism, 12 noon at the State Library. And another rally, Close Pine Gap. That's at the 1:30 at the Defence Plaza, Melbourne, 661 Bourke Street. So yeah, a few mobilisations happening tomorrow. And, of course, you can wander on down to the 3CR Community Day. If you're going to one of those rallies, you can head on over to Collingwood afterwards. Opening night is an exhibition, A Space for What Cannot Be Said, 6 p.m. at the Artful Yoga Gallery, 1 Vale Street, St Kilda, tomorrow night. And there's also a fundraiser gig tomorrow, Songs of Solidarity, Phil Mansour, and Sophie Nishizawa, 7 p.m. at Dukana, 99 to 101 Harding Street, Coburg.
Sunday, July 5th, the history of Latin America through music and food, 3 p.m. Balambalam Place, 15 Phoenix Street, Brunswick. Music, Best of Tarab, 7th anniversary concert. That's at 6 p.m. at the Brunswick Ballroom, 314 Sydney Road in Brunswick.
And
Monday?
Yeah, Monday, July 6th. AHPRA's adoption of the IHRA, a free online briefing for healthcare workers. That is 6:30 online.
Yeah, that's affecting the hundreds and thousands of healthcare workers that could potentially lose their jobs because of this IHRA definition of anti-Semitism that's been imposed on them. So it would be a good one to get to. Already 1,500 healthcare workers have signed a petition opposing this. Wednesday, July 8th, there's a webinar, Intellectual Freedom, Palestine and the Future of Australian Universities. That's 6 p.m. online. There's more information if you head to Green Left. If you head to Green Left, there's a link to more information.
And then we were talking before to Narendra about the Australians Against Islamophobia group and the rally that they're organising. That's coming up on Thursday, July 9. Melbourne protest against Modi. That's at 5 p.m. Location to be confirmed, but I'm aware that there's a rally for Modi at Marvel Stadium or you know, whatever you want to call it, a Modi fest. At Marvel Stadium on Thursday. So I'm guessing the protest may be in that area or maybe not. But, yeah, keep an eye out. Melbourne protest against Modi on Thursday. There's also a public discussion, Housing Solutions for Footscray, People's Plans for Footscray, 6:30 p.m. At Borderlands Cooperative, 77A, Paisley Street in Footscray. And, of course, Borderlands Cooperative, they've got a show here on 3CR, and they're freaking legends. So, yes, Thursday, July 9, public housing, housing solutions for Footscray, the People's Plan for Footscray.
Friday, July 10th, there's going to be two film screenings. One film screening is Cuba After Castro. That's 6:30 p.m. at the Kathleen Syme Library and Community Centre Multipurpose Room 1. And that's 251 Faraday Street in Carlton. And we might have a Latin duo play some music before. They might play some Cuban music before that film screening. So try to get there early. Another film screening on the same day, Until the Sky Falls Quiet at 7 p.m. at the Newlands Neighbourhood House, 20 Murray Road in Coburg North.
All right. Well, should we have another song?
Yeah, perhaps? I reckon. What about Hath No Fury?
Yes. All right.
Let's do it. Hate the poison!
George Jones!
Word. That was Hath No Fury by La Familia off their new album Alphabet Mafia. That's another one from Matt Ward's album wrap-up in Green Left. And La Familia are a local Melbourne act here from Melbourne, and fronted by a trans musician, Beth Seymour. And the new album addresses transphobia, discrimination, misogyny, trauma, resilience, and queer solidarity. So, yeah, shout out to La Familia. That is some freaking rad punk right there. And if you're, I'm sure they'll be playing some gigs around town. So, go check them out, because that is the goodness right there.
Yeah. Just a couple of things. We left off the calendar, so... it's a while away, but July 18th, which is a Saturday, is the Sydney Road Accessible Tram Stop campaign, the third anniversary. Shameful that we have to keep. It's been 3 years, but 11 a.m. corner Wilson Avenue and Sydney Road, Brunswick. Put that in your calendar.
Yes. and then Saturday, the 25th of July. There is a community rally, Unite Against Racism, Migrants Are Welcome, Saturday 25th of July, Broadmeadows Town Hall, Dimboola Road, Broadmeadows at 2 p.m. And yeah, look, that's, I think you can expect to see more community mobilizations against racism and Islamophobia in the lead up to the state election later this year and the federal election in another couple of years. With the rise of One Nation, it is really important to stand up and be counted and push back against the absolutely disgusting, toxic white supremacist politics. So come along to that. There'll be different community organizations with speakers at that rally, and show your fly the flag of anti-racism in Broadytown.
Well, we're going to go to a quick break, and we're going to come back with our last interview of the program. So don't go anywhere.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the Apartheid Free Zone movement.
Kefiyas are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefiyah to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefiyas.org.au, that's kefiyas.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Welcome back. You are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and we are happy to be joined by Sarah Barini. Sarah Barini is from the Lebanese community. They're an activist and organizer, including some of the big Free Palestine Sunday rallies here in Nam. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, we invited you on this morning because we want to give listeners a bit of a rundown on the current situation on the ground in Lebanon. Would you be able to give us a little bit of that, a rundown in the context of West Asia more broadly?
So unfortunately, we've been witnessing a live stream genocide that's been happening for over now 78 years against the Palestinian people. What we've been seeing over the last 3 years in particular has been an escalation of Israeli aggression against the Palestinian people in Palestine, but also a renewed push for the Zionist project and the Greater Israel project. And under the Greater Israel project, Zionists are really hoping to secure all of historic Palestine and then push and occupy Lebanon as well, the remaining area of Syria, noting that it does occupy the Golan Heights at the moment, and also pushing through Jordan and Egypt as well. So what we've been seeing over the last 3 years has been a renewed push, particularly in Palestine, to continue the ethnic cleansing and occupation and genocide of the Palestinian people, but also renewed push in Lebanon as well to try and expand Israeli territory. We've now hit 100 days since the escalation of the genocide in Gaza. Since the invasion of Lebanon, we've seen over 4,200 people that have been killed, over 12,000 people injured, and at its height, more than 1.2 million people that were displaced in Lebanon as well. Again, at the height, we saw 20% of Lebanon, South Lebanon, occupied. There's now been a reduction in that, and it's now 6%. But nonetheless, Lebanese territory continues to be occupied as well as we speak. Unfortunately, like the destruction, just as in the Gaza, we've seen widespread destruction. In Lebanon, there's also mass destruction. 45% of urban areas in South Lebanon have been damaged or destroyed. What we're witnessing right now is Israel continuing to act without any regard for international law. We've seen historically they've even used weapons that are illegal under international law, including the use of white phosphorus in Lebanon. Many people will remember also the war crime that was committed by Israeli forces with the explosion of pagers as well in Lebanon. The crimes that Israel continues to commit are horrifying and should alarm everyone. The state of Israel continues to violate international law without the international community doing anything to hold it accountable, including the Australian government as well.
Late last week, thousands took to the streets of Beirut with massive protests sweeping the city. Sarah, can you tell us about these and explain the 26 June US-Israel-Lebanon trilateral framework agreement that sparked the protest?
So obviously, given the situation in Lebanon and destruction, the Lebanese government has been in talks with Israel and the United States, noting that obviously, Israel and the United States have been putting a lot of pressure on the Lebanese government to enter into an agreement. As we've seen time and time again, ceasefire agreements have been reached with Israel and then subsequently violated by Israel, not only in Lebanon but in Palestine as well. What we saw late last month was Lebanon and Israel and the United States agreed to an in-principle agreement and effectively normalization and to commit to entering into normalization talks and a long-term agreement. The Lebanese people reject that, and we saw protests in response. Just for context, Lebanon has been subjected to multiple aggressions by Israel throughout history and since the establishment of Israel, since the establishment of Israel, and Lebanon does not hold diplomatic ties with Israel at present, and historically, working with Israel and normalizing ties with Israel has been considered to be treacherous. And now the Lebanese people see that the government is openly engaging in that treachery and are taking issue with that.
Sarah, thanks heaps for speaking with us this morning. This is Zane. It'd be cool if you could talk a bit about Hezbollah and the diversity of political opinion in Lebanon. I know that Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Defense Minister, Israel Katz, Donald Trump, they sort of justify the attacks on southern Lebanon by saying, oh, well, Hezbollah is there and therefore we have to, occupy the southern part of Lebanon and create this kind of safety buffer. Can you comment on the nature of Hezbollah? They imply that it's just this kind of Iranian-backed foreign entity. That's not really the truth, as I understand it. Can you comment a bit about that?
Look, I think that we need to put into context when Hezbollah was established and why. Hezbollah was established during the second Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. Prior to that, we had UNIFIL, which is United Nations Peacekeeping Force, in Lebanon in place since 1978. So basically, despite the existence of UNIFIL, which continues to be in place at the moment, Israel has continued to violate international law and continued to attempt to occupy and invade Lebanon. So Hezbollah came about during the second invasion of Lebanon to try and protect South Lebanon and protect Lebanese sovereignty. Now, obviously, there are disputing opinions about Hezbollah and their operation, but their primary focus is maintaining territory sovereignty and protecting the South against Israeli occupation and aggression. What I guess my concern is, and a lot of people, is that Hezbollah has been and will continue to be used as an excuse for Israel continuing to violate international law and continuing to breach ceasefire agreements and continuing to essentially collectively punish Lebanese people. And we can see that it's used the same tactic in Palestine as well, and using Hamas to to blame Palestinians and to basically brainwash people into manufacturing consent for the collective punishment of Palestinians in Palestine. So it's the same tactic that we're seeing being used at the moment as well. But, you know, we're seeing hospitals being bombed and there is no justification for that. And even just yesterday, we saw a hospital in South Lebanon being bombed. We've seen the same tactic being deployed in Palestine as well. But there is no justification for these crimes. Lebanon has, the right to its sovereignty, and people have a right to continue to live their life peacefully and freely, as do the Palestinian people. And Israel must be held accountable for the crimes that it's committing and the breaches of sovereignty that it continues to commit.
And Sarah, can you talk a bit about the Litani River for listeners who may not be familiar with the geography of Lebanon and the southern part of Lebanon? Why does Israel want to capture the Litani River? And how long have they had that in their sights, kind of capturing part of Lebanon right up to and including the Litani River?
So the Zionist Project, under the Zionist Project and Plans for Greater Israel, it doesn't just want the Litani River, it really wants, Israel is seeking to gain all of Lebanon, unfortunately. Basically, it is a vital water source, and Israel's strategy has essentially been to try and cripple communities and also to continue to commit basically an ecocide as well. It's destroying land and natural resources, and the Lotani River is one of the essential and historical areas of Lebanon that it is trying to make sure that it can take and cripple. It's pretty significant for Lebanon's agriculture and economic needs as well, and it's just another way through which Israel is hoping to cripple the Lebanese people.
Sarah, thank you for coming on Green Left Radio this morning. Are there any last words you would like to leave our listeners with, or anything you'd like to plug before we wrap up?
I just want to remind people that I think that a lot of us have noticed that we're not seeing the situation in Lebanon or in Palestine being reported as frequently, but that doesn't mean that Israel isn't continuing to commit its aggressions against people on a daily basis. So the responsibility is on us to continue to educate ourselves and keep ourselves informed, and to keep our eyes on Palestine, to keep our eyes on Lebanon, and to continue to take action in each and every single way that we can. So that means looking out on social media for any actions that are coming up, not only protests, but any other actions as well, and campaigns that are taking place. So keep an eye out on social media. There are so many different groups that are doing incredible work, but just continue to speak up and continue to take action. And thank you for listening as always.
Yeah, really good to have you on the show, Sarah. And also thank you for all your hard work in building the protest movement. It's important, like you said, it's more important than ever that we keep speaking out against Israel's attack on Lebanon and its ongoing genocide in Gaza, despite a supposed ceasefire. Thank you once again, Sarah. We'll have to have you back on the show in the future.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks heaps. And yeah, I think it's worth remembering too, like around the world, one of the places that's got, you know, where public opinion has really shifted to become very openly critical of the actions of the Israeli state is here in Australia. And it's because of community organising and getting that alternative perspective out there and normalising the truth. Like, this Zionist project has just lied to people for decades about what's going on there and dehumanized Lebanese people and Palestinians. So, yeah, much respect to Sarah and to every other grassroots activist who's been doing the hard yards over the last couple years and over the last couple decades, because, yeah, public opinion can shift, and it has shifted a lot in Australia recently.
Yeah, there's a recent Pew, it's a reputable survey, it's worldwide, respected worldwide, recently came out with some incredible figures talking about how Australia is ranked among the most critical populations regarding Israel and Netanyahu, and it's something like 79%. I mean, there's different statistics, but they're all overwhelmingly, even the conservative, like centre, are overwhelmingly against Israel. And that is really a testament to the Palestine movement here, but also we're part of the global solidarity movement, and not forgetting the Palestinians on the ground in Palestine fighting for their lives every single day. All right, we're going to, unfortunately, we've come to the end of the show. We're going to play a quick announcement, and we'll just stay with us. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
Yes, you are listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR. We're coming to the end of the show. And as you just heard, make sure you subscribe to 3CR if you haven't already to keep it kicking and ticking and rocking.
Yeah, thanks, listeners, for tuning in this week. We want to thank our guests, Sarah Barini and Narendra from the Indian diaspora. And if you want to support Green Left, if you've enjoyed the show, please consider becoming a Green Left supporter. As little as $5 a month, help us to continue to report on workers, climate and social justice movements. Go to greenleft.org.au/support.
Yes, yes. And we've got Left After Breakfast coming up real soon. Mm. And before we go to that, I think I'll just give a plug to the Eco-Socialism 2026 conference. It's coming up from the 11th to the 13th of September at the Albion Peace Centre in Maganjin, Brisbane. And there's going to be a bunch of speakers there from Sabrina Fernandez from Brazil, Ian Angus from Canada, Aisha Ahmad from Pakistan, Rima Naji from Maganjin, Brisbane, Ensai Balaji from India, Rocky from Singapore. So, yeah, lots of international speakers. Check it out, Eco-Socialism Conference. That's us for another week.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Morning Breakfast with Green Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
If you like our work, become a supporter from $5 per month at greenleft.org.au/support or free call 1800 634 206.
Arise, you workers from your slumbers. Arise, you prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders and at last ends the age of Khan.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.